Welcome to Sisters of Sound. I'm your host, Morgan Shepherd, and today I'm chatting with Lorraine Segato. She's been in the music industry for a long time, well over 30 years. You might recognize her hit song, Rise Up. Rise up, rise up. She was the lead singer in Parachute Club, a Toronto new wave rock pop group that formed in the early 80s. And throughout her career in music, she's worked activism into her work through songwriting, art exhibits, filmmaking, artist residencies, and much more. She's a really fascinating lady. We've worked with her here a couple times at Tattoo Sound and Music, and we thought she would be an amazing lady to talk to. She's here now to share her story. So first of all, Lorraine, thank you so much for coming in today.
It's my pleasure. I'm happy to be here with you.
How's your summer going?
You know, it's kind of busy this summer, so I don't feel like I've had one yet, but it's the weather's beautiful at least, so.
Right. I feel like summers just keep going faster and faster.
I know. It's the first week of August, and it's almost over.
Right. So we want to talk about a little bit of everything to do with you. We like to kind of get a whole summary of all of our guests and cover as much as we can. And like I said, we have no time limit, so we can chat all afternoon as long as you're down. But let's start off chatting about when Parachute Club formed. And even before that, it was a very different time in music than it is now, which fascinates me. There was no social media, no YouTube, and Rise Up was recorded a year, even before much music was on the air.
Yeah.
What did it take back then to make such an iconic song and be so successful?
Oh, there's a lot of questions in that. Okay, well, let me scooch back to in the late 70s. When I first came to Toronto, I had studied film at Sheridan College for several years, thinking I myself would become a recording engineer or a producer because I needed to have another, I wanted to be a musician for a living, but I knew I needed to have another fallback position. So when I came to Toronto, the first group that I got into was a group called Mama Kia 2, which was a seven-piece, all they called themselves a seven-piece all-woman rock and roll, no, seven-piece all-woman lesbian radical, no, wait, let's start over. In 1978, when I first joined Mama Kia, they called themselves a lesbian feminist all-woman rock and roll band. And that was a really amazing moment for me because it took me out of playing acoustic guitar into playing electric guitar and playing collaboratively and writing collaboratively. And that band led to all the other bands that followed, which were V. And V was a radical dub funk reggae band that I was a co-lead singer with a guy named Moja, Moja at that point was a very well-known singer in the group Truth and Rights, which was a political band as well. And so you had a Rasta man and you had a lesbian in the same
Love
group
it.
Together, right? and so we did that group and we also created original material. And then out of that group came the Parachute Club, which was a seven-piece group. With members of which I had played with in Mama Kia, like the keyboard player Lori Conger, who was in Parachute Club, was also in Mama Kia, and Billy Bryans, my partner in the Parachute Club, was the only male drummer that sort of identified as a feminist, so I brought him into Mama Kia because there were no women drummers once the woman drummer quit.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
So I brought him into that group. So, you know, there was a lot of partnerships that actually were, you know, traveled from band to band, you know, from Mama
yep.
Kia to V to Parachute Club. And it's impossible to talk about Parachute Club without talking about Mama Kia or V
For
because
sure.
we all three of those groups, really, we came out of a grassroots community in the, you know, late 70s, early 80s. Let me paint a picture for you. Toronto was a small town, conservative, still kind of Prohibition era almost, you know, in its mores and in its values. There was a wave of immigrants coming through, Caribbean immigrants, all manner of immigrants from the Caribbean islands. So the music scene was starting to change. You had Queen Street, because there had been a recession in the early 80s, Queen Street you would not recognize because it was all warehouses that were empty because of the recession. So artists moved into that area and took over the space and started creating do-it-yourself, you know, events and parties and booze cans and all of these kinds of things. And Parachute Club and Mama Kia Envy came out of that collectivity and that community of do-it-yourself musicians and artists.
Mm-hmm. So how did the success come?
Well, the success, first of all, was a surprise.
Okay.
Because what had happened was, the first time that we played as Parachute Club, we were playing a booze can. There was an illegal booze can called the MBC, which was run by Richard O'Brien and Patty Habib, who later opened the Bamboo Club. And the Bamboo Club went on to become the single most important world music club, not only in Toronto, but across the country. And we were playing this booze can, and there was a record company guys there from Current Records. They were a young independent record company, and they had Martha and the Muffins, and they had a couple of other people, and they came to see us, and they offered us a demo deal. And we decided, Billy and I, as partners in Parachute Club, mm-hmm. we're looking at each other going, do we really want to make a demo yet? And we decided, okay, we'll do that. So we did this demo with them, went to Trinidad to learn how to play soca music. And,
wow.
And, you know, we were there learning. Moja, who is from Trinidad, was there. He had his family and all his friends there. And while we were there, we got this record deal with through the demo with RCA and Current Records. When we came back, we had to finish the record. We didn't have enough songs. And so we came back, we finished the songs. We went back to Grant Ave's studio, and Danny Lamois was our producer from Grant Ave's studio. And we created this album of material, of which the song Rise Up was the last song we finished. Then we put it out in 1983, which is now 35 years ago.
Wow.
And the song, crazily enough, just cut through everything and became this crazy anthem, because you have to understand, at that time, the new music was going on and much music wasn't there yet.
Yep.
And it was just morphing into much music. You had MTV that just started, and all the radio stations like Chum, they had Chum TV and all of that. They had these video charts, but there were not that many videos. So our video was on constant rotation because there was not that many Canadian videos. So our video was on constant rotation, which meant that our song was on constant rotation. And those were the days where people really called in and said, you know, play that song again.
Yes.
So our song kind of cut through this whole, it was like I like to always say it's like a crack in the wall that we kind of slipped through in a way, because at that point there was, you know, Bryan Adams, Corey Hart, Loverboy, Paola's, you know, it was rock and roll, male rock and roll bands,
yeah.
And it was blues, not so much in the radio, but blues on the kind of AC, like 104.5, and then you had folk, but you didn't have world music.
Yeah.
World music was not, like, being played at all. So we were, like, what we were doing was so weird and so different, and it just caught on. So that's how the success happened. I like to say it was a confluence of energies that was luck, timing, you know, right place, right time, and then a modicum of talent. You know?
When you were writing the song, did you have any sort of warm fuzzies like, this is it?
No, I didn't. I think some of the other writers, co-writers, you know, felt really good about the song. I think that I was probably the biggest naysayer
really
around this song until the very end. Well, because, you know, all the other material we did, so, you know, Alienation, Boys Club, Are You Hungry, She Tell You, which was a song about goddess culture, all of the stuff that we wrote was really in the margins and a very political insight.
Yeah.
It was political, you know, it was political without, I don't mean NDP, liberal. I mean, it was just all about social justice and all about all of that stuff. So because that was the bulk of our sort of playing material, as well as funk songs and, you know, James Brown and that, cover tunes, we were focused on trying to create a vibe that was really represented, you know, what the Parachute Club was about. And because it was our last song, it really hadn't come together. And Rise Up in itself, there were like three different sets of lyrics that on the day that I had to sing the song, you know, for the,
yep.
you know, it was like I was kind of pulling this verse and that
wow.
verse and this verse and this chorus and that and, you know, just kind of mooshing it as it went
yep.
along. And then it took a producer like Daniel Lanois to actually create the opening, which was this very big opening, and just his production style. He really, I think, he made that song come alive. You
very
know?
Cool. Our Ossington studio is near Queen West, where that neighborhood would have been close to where all of this was happening back then. And yeah, it's totally different now. It's so commercial, and a lot of venues have shut down for young musicians who are trying to make it. And, you know, if there is any gallery space, it's rented for $500 a day from some corporation. How does this affect being a musician who's trying to come up now?
Well, you know, I can't speak to what's happening for younger folks right now, although one of the things I do see is that there are more festivals than ever before and more places to play, not like traditional venues like the ones that we had. Like, so in the early days for us, it would have been, we would create events, like I say, in these warehouse spaces,
yep.
like these, you know, like these pop-up illegal booze cans, and
mm-hmm.
we would do that. And then there were these places to play that you really aimed for, like the Elma Combo and
mm-hmm.
Bamboo and the Horseshoe and all of these kinds of things on your way up, right? And you're right, there's not so many of those anymore. It's hard to think of Toronto calling itself a music city when, in fact, there are so few places for people to play. However, there are more festivals to play and more other ways of getting the kinds of attention that younger musicians want. And speaking of Ossington, you know, before Ossington became Ossington, we used to go and rehearse in this really grungy space there at the base of Queen and Ossington. And that whole strip was just bad karaoke bars, and no one would go there. And now it's this go-to destination. So I think, you know what, in saying that, what I'm saying is things are always morphing.
Yep.
You know?
And gentrification.
Yeah, and gentrification is part of what makes it morph, but it's always the creators, the artists who change neighborhoods and cities and cultural spaces so that people want to go there.
Absolutely.
And I think it should be built into a city's planning, that there is a way of remunerating or, you know, giving back to the cultural workers of the city who, you know, bring enough creativity to the area that people want to live there.
Yeah. It's such a huge reason for people wanting to live somewhere. And it's not even something that is thought about.
Yeah.
But pinpointing that, it's art that moves people.
Yeah. Well, you know, if you One of the interesting things about someone goes through their life and they say, you know, I can't tell you how many times someone has said to me, I remember I was right here and I was in the mall and so when I heard this song and I was with my boyfriend and we had this thing and there was this thing. And they had, you know, they have a whole memory that they have attached to a song that you have written. And that goes with film and music and writing and literary. Like, it's across the board for everybody. We attach our memories of growing up, of pain, of sorrow, of sadness, of happiness, of celebration, of friends, of loyalty, to creativity, you know, to creative moments. And yet, what's fascinating is the hardest thing in the world is to get access for creators to actually have a flow through of a stream of revenue so that they can actually keep creating without suffering. Like ridiculous to me. I just can never figure that out.
And this is something that you're passionate about.
Yeah.
And it seems like in one way or another, activism always comes into your creative work.
Yeah, yeah.
Has it always been like that?
Yes. And I was thinking about this the other day because I was like, why? There were so many opportunities to make loads of cash, right?
Yeah.
And I was like, what was I thinking? But I think, you know, for me, it was, I have to go back to when I was younger. I am the daughter of immigrants, Italian immigrants who came here to this country to make a better life. When I was younger, I was constantly being beaten up and you know, ostracized and told to go back to my country and all. It was just awful. Like, I was constantly being bullied. And I remember that the effect it had on me was, instead of making me feel victimized, was it made me fight back. Like, I must have been born with a strong spirit because
definitely
it made me want to fight back. And so that when I came to the larger city and I thought to myself, I saw how people were being treated, and I went, no. Because for me, music was a way of getting out of the alienation that I had as a teenager, and most teenagers have, you know, that feeling of where do I belong and how do I belong. Music was my survival for that, like writing. And I thought somewhere along the line, when I came to a big city, it started to click and it started to morph into this whole thing where I can be the voice for other people who feel the same way. So you'll notice not a lot of my music. There's not a lot of love songs.
Mm-hmm.
There's not a lot. I don't really write personally so much. I write about things I believe in and ideas that I have and opinions I have about how I'd love to see the world. You know,
which is it's a really lovely thing to do. And I think that I know for our generation, we wish a lot more current artists were like that. You see all of these awful things happening in the world. And
yeah.
Then an artist like Taylor Swift, who she has such a powerful voice, but she won't speak about anything.
Yeah.
And it's kind of a waste.
Yeah, it is. I want to say that without sounding judgmental around her, because she has this incredible power. She could be changing large portions of the world. And in terms of, you know, young girls and young teenage boys, she could be totally affecting them to use their energy to create a way better world than the world that we have created for our children, you know, and our friends' children. Yeah, you know, but the thing is, there's a price you pay for that. Like, I remember it was really difficult being a political, you know,
yeah.
a political person in the age that I came through. I was ostracized all the time. Mainstream radio really didn't want to play us, and the only reason why they played us is because everybody kept buying the record and the song, you know, and we had a run there for a period of maybe about 7 years, 7-8 years. That was, you know, there was really very few months where we didn't have a song going up the charts or coming down the charts. Rise Up opened the door for that.
Yeah.
But it, you know, in terms of the industry, I was never very much appreciated at all. I was thought to be too opinionated, yep. too political, too. People were, like, if anything, afraid of me.
You weren't fitting into the formula.
I wasn't fitting into the formula. And now I see some of the stuff that is happening with younger artists, and I think that is so amazing. I'm so grateful that all these, some doors have changed.
Yes.
You know, some things have happened. You know, the whole Me Too movement thing has cracked open a series of memories for a lot of women I know of my generation who were in the music business who had a hellacious time during that period of time and actually had to compartmentalize everything that was happening to them so that they could actually, you know, have a career, right? So it's so neat to see that there are artists who are not afraid to say, this is what I believe and this is what, you know, what yeah. I'm connected to.
What are some of your favorite newer artists right now?
Oh, that's hard. Well, I like what Serena Ryder is doing.
Mm-hmm.
I tend to love Canadian. I you know, it's kind of crazy, but I kind of tend to love my peers more than anything, mm-hmm. like the Canadian people that yeah. I know. There's a woman that people don't really know about because they know her as an actress. Rebecca Jenkins is a great singer. Mika Barnes, who is in town, is a great singer. Molly Johnson mm-hmm. has this long history of stuff. So I tend to kind of listen to and love
yep.
Either my friends or my colleagues. Maybe as we go along, I'll come up with
totally.
Someone more exciting.
Yeah, yeah.
But
no worries. When I was reading about you, I read about your relationship with Jack Layton and the work you did with him. Tell us about that.
Interesting guy. So Jack Layton and his wife, Olivia Chow, both worked in City Hall mm-hmm. Or as counselors. And they used to go to the Bamboo Club all the time. And they'd come to see our band, Parachute Club. And Jack really loved the song Rise Up and he really loved our band. And I'd always see them at Caravana. Because
yep.
we'd all, you know, the Bamboo would have a float, and then we'd all get dressed up and go to Caravana, and our band would play, and, you know, it was just this great kind of feeling of community. And then Jack was making a run for the NDP leadership, and he asked me, can I use Rise Up? And I went, well, you know, I know you love that. Oh, and I played their wedding, too.
Like,
so I played their wedding, which I've never done weddings before, but I remember playing their wedding at St. Lawrence Market. And I said, well, we try not to associate it to a political moment, but I'll write a song for you. So I wrote the song called Bringing All the People Together or something like that. You know, something that sounded kind of like
yep.
Rise Up. And he ran for 4 and won the NDP leadership, and that was fantastic. And then,
Because of your song.
I'm not sure about that. But then I produced some events for him when he was, running for, I think, the federal election. I produced some events for him, and I got a whole bunch of musicians I just produced the event. To do stuff for him. So I kept working with him in various ways of trying to get cultural people on board with the NDP and everything. And then Jack, got ill and he got ill. And I received a phone call from his family saying Jack would really love it if you would play his funeral. So that was, and then I played the kind of state funeral for Jack Layton, and that was
what
like.
What was that like?
That was so wild. That was the wildest. Can I tell you this story?
Yes.
So I was up at a friend's cottage, and I got a phone call, and I think it was 5 o'clock in the morning, and I knew that Jack was ill again. But you know, he was so positive and such a fighter, and I didn't know it was that, you know, advanced. So I got this phone call, and the phone call was like, they'd like you to sing at the state funeral, Jack's passed, you know? And I said, I was, okay, sure, you know? And then here I am at this cottage, and it's this beautiful, hot, humid day, and I was just filled with grief. Like, it just so much grief, like so much potential loss, and not just a friend, but just what he stood for and this feeling of, you know, what could be in this country. And then I started to get all these phone calls from the press, right? And who wanted to talk to me because they'd heard I was going to sing Rise Up at the state funeral. This is like on the same day.
Wow.
So I had my partner call Olivia Chow and the family and say, this is happening and I feel really uncomfortable about it. You know, do you want me to talk to them? And they said, yes, we'd rather you talk. At least you can talk about it. You know, we can't talk right now, blah, blah, blah. So I spent the whole week doing these crazy interviews around the upcoming thing. But I didn't have, and in the meantime, his casket was making his way from Ottawa to Toronto, and people were visiting him, you know, at City Hall. He was laying in state. And because I was doing interviews all the time, I didn't get a chance to say goodbye to him. And so I'll never forget this moment when the night before the actual state funeral, we went and did a rehearsal. And see, I'm getting emotional just thinking about it. We did this rehearsal with the people, the band and all of this. And there's a stage manager there and everything. And there's this big kind of like taped out area. And then on the other side is where, you know, the Brent Hawkes, the pastor, was going to be and everything. And I go to run through the song. And I'm so raw because I've been doing these interviews all week. And I haven't been able to say goodbye to Jack. And I start to sing the song, and I just feel so emotional. This is in the rehearsal, right? Mm-hmm. I'm so emotional. I can barely keep it together. And I'm in the middle of the song, and I go to cross the stage, as I often do, because I want to connect to people. And the stage manager stops the song in the middle of it and goes, no, 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 you can't do that. You can't do that. That's where Jack's coffin will be. You can't cross the coffin. And right in that moment, I just lost my shit. I was kind of like, oh my God, you can't stop me in the middle of a song like this.
Yeah.
Like, and you needed to tell me that like before, because then I realized, oh my God, he's going to be right there.
Yeah. Yeah. And, it's like a pretty important thing to know.
Right. And I didn't, anyways, I hadn't, that was really emotional. And then the next day I hadn't got a chance to see him. Anyways, I managed to arrange it with someone that before the coffin went on stage that I got to say goodbye. Because my friend who was singing with me, who was singing in the background, she's an amazing singer, Alana Bridgewater. I don't know if you know her, but she's an incredible singer. She said to me, Lorraine, you need to say goodbye to him before you go on stage. Otherwise, you won't be able to keep this together. Because that happened to me when my father died, she said. I said, okay. So I had to go through all this stuff with people and security guards and RCMP and everything to say, I need like 5 minutes.
Yeah, you needed your time.
Yeah. It was so insane.
Wow. So how was the actual performance?
I don't think I was very good on the performance. I was so emotional.
Yeah.
And I remember I had a whole bunch of trolls, sort of someone had said to me, I can't believe it. All these trolls going, oh, I have to listen to Lorraine singing out of tune again.
Oh
kind
my
of
God.
Like because I was on, you know how it is when you're on TV, the sound is never really good, mm-hmm. No matter what they do. Sound is awful. And I was so emotional. There's no doubt in my mind I wasn't singing properly. Like, it was just to get through it.
Yeah.
And then, you know, Olivia and her family are right in the front there. And to the left is Stephen Harper and the whole conservative caucus who don't want to be there at all. So
yeah.
Their energy is like, you know, Darth Vader.
It's like a black cloud in front
just
of your face.
Like, it's just really, really, it was completely like Voldemort over there,
gosh.
Right? And then there's, you know, the grieving NDP, and the Liberals were at least very gracious and elegant, you know, because it's a state funeral. But there were energies, I mean, strong energies. So I'm looking out into the thing, and there's all these different energies, and I'm like, I can't even manage that.
Well, kudos to you for doing that. And you know what? It was for Jack. So
it was for Jack.
That's all that matters.
I became the funeral singer. I was his wedding singer and his funeral singer. Like, talk about a bookend.
Oh, wow. But that's what he wanted.
He wanted it, and I honored him. I mean, I felt honored. I remember saying to Brent Hawks, who was the pastor there, I'm going, Brent, he could have anybody. Well, you know, Stephen Page also sang, and there were all these other people. He loved so many musicians. I think it was the song that he was really connected to, and I said to Brent, oh, why would he choose me of all the people? Anybody could sing this song even, you know? You could. And he said, he chose you, and you need to stay with that and what that means for you. And what's really interesting about it is I feel Jack to be my ancestor. Like, I feel him.
Mm-hmm.
Like, I feel my ex-partner, Billy Bryans, who passed away also, you know, who I started Parachute Club with. I feel them all the time.
Wow.
Yeah, I mean, I just feel them, like, as a vibe. I don't even know how to describe it, but when I have to make a big decision, I kind of look to the sky and go, Jack, Billy?
What would you do?
What do I do now?
Oh, wow. That's a great story. So we work with licensing music here at Tattoo, and often we chat about how advertisers, you know, they always want to go for a big song. And something that resonates. As an artist, how do you decide who gets to use your music?
Well, you know, not a lot of people have used our music except for in the past.
Mm-hmm.
The only songs that they ever tried to use was Rise Up. One was for an orange juice commercial, and another time with Rise Up, it was Rising Crust Pizza, which they kind of, our publisher had used it without our permission, so we had to sue. We had this huge lawsuit around Rise Up, and it was very controversial at the time. But
why was it controversial? Because you stood your ground?
Yes, because we decided to sue. And I remember it was controversial for a million reasons because, well, first of all, they sold it without our permission. Rise Up was the one song, I don't know, I can't even believe we were smart enough to do this, but we had this thing called a moral rights waiver, which was for the song Rise Up because it represented so much to so many people. We did this thing where we went, it cannot be sold for religious, political, advertising purposes without the express consent of all of the writers. So we are not waiving our moral rights.
Mm-hmm.
You can't just attach it to anything. We need to know everything about it. Well, our publisher sold the song, did a sound alike, you know, sound exactly like me and the singers and the band and the musicians, paid, I think, an exorbitant amount of money in U.S. money. McCain's had paid them an exorbitant amount of money. We never saw any of it. And then they paid for the recording and all of that kind of stuff. So everybody who did it got paid, and we didn't see any of it. And our fans had kept seeing it on the TV screen, and they were writing to us going, you sold out. You sold out to a pizza commercial. So we decided to, because it was a breach of contract, we took them to court, and then, or we took them to, I guess it would be discovery, and it was in discovery that we basically got all our publishing back. But what that caused was this incredible controversy, because I had all these people coming up to me going, well, you're not even a band anymore, like, what do you care? And then someone had gone up to the singer who had done the sing-alike and said, oh, Lorraine Segato's going to screw you over by, she's going to sue you. And then all these people were like, you know, you've really messed up all the publishing contracts because now everybody's going to lock down on the moral rights waiver and you'll never, you know, nobody will ever have that kind of freedom again. And so there was all these reasons why people were angry at us instead of going, we fought and we won.
Yeah, which I think is a great thing. Like, and as far as I know, now that comes into play every time with licensing, an artist has to sign off.
Yes.
So there would be no rising crust without you know that the crust was rising.
That's right. Well, and the thing is, I don't have a, listen, I have no problem with advertising and the attachment of popular songs to it, you know. I think that composers need to make a living and they need to do it in whatever way they can do it. That's amazing. And I've often said to the writers of the song Rise Up, anyways, I've said, you know, like if Microsoft Word or Evian Water or anybody who was really Apple or anybody who was really interesting came to us and said, we want to use your song, I think we should go with something that has a branded value that is really, really interesting. But no one's ever come to us, so I'm like, okay, that's cool. And there were so many other songs they could have used that they've never come to us for. So I don't have a lot of experience with advertising, but I do think it's a great way for composers to move forward, as you know, with an income stream, no?
And probably even more so in Canada.
Yeah, probably, yeah.
Where it's a bit more difficult to get your name out there at
first. Yeah, yeah.
So tell us about Get Off My Dress.
Get Off My Dress is my production company. I found that when at a very early age in it that I had a curiosity of not just about music, but about everything technical, and going out on tour and all of these kinds of things allowed me to see the importance of every element of something. So from lighting to, you know, production, sound, like all of the aspects of it were interesting to me. So I created a production company called Get Off My Dress Productions, and everything I produce or everything I do kind of filters through that. But also, at the present moment, I've been, for a very long time, writing a one-woman show called Get Off My Dress. And that's going to hopefully be out sometime 2018, 2019. So, you know, production company, one-woman show.
And is the show about your life?
The show is an autobiographical show about my life. It's a philosophical journey that one takes. And it's got the music, like, not just from Parachute Club, but my original music and some other material I've written. And it's monologue, and it's got film in it and graphics. And
very cool.
It's a whole show.
So where can we follow along with when it's going to be released?
Well, I would imagine at the point at which I go to workshop it. First, you know, the thing about theater or theatrical production is very different than doing a record. You know, you release a record and if it doesn't go, too bad. But with plays, what you can do is you can workshop, you could just keep changing it. Like it's constantly morphing and you keep changing it. And I really like that because as a person who loves to continuously be changing stuff, so you could workshop it for a long time and then you can tour it. And I think, so by the time I get to the workshop stage, I'll put that up on the website. And
great.
And I'll have probably a website just for Get Off My Dress.
Perfect. Get that domain.
Yeah, I got it. I got that domain.
Love it. Because you're local here in Toronto, I always like throwing in a question about the city. If you were to take your best friend out for a birthday dinner on the weekend, where would you go?
A birthday dinner. Well, I really love, actually not far from here, is a place called Ruby Watch Co. And they have a fixed price birthday, or they have a fixed price dinner.
Yep.
And the food is fantastic. And on Friday nights, it wouldn't just be the restaurant I take it to, it'd have to be on a Friday night, because they have hand-caught Fogo Island cod.
Nice. Newfoundland.
Yep.
Beautiful.
And they actually, the people in Fogo Island are very, very few of them. They actually make a living doing hand-caught cod and delivering it to certain restaurants.
Yep.
And it's sustainable and it's really beautiful and the fish is beautiful. And the woman who runs it, Lynn Crawford, is a well-known chef.
Yep.
And she's, you know, it's just consistently a great place. So I would take someone there.
Beautiful. I'm going to have to make a reservation now. Well, thank you so much for coming on with us.
My pleasure.
Sisters of Sound is produced by Tattoo Sound and Music in Toronto, Ontario, Canada. I'm your host, Morgan Shepherd. Subscribe on your favorite podcast platform today.